Today, I'm speaking with Sime Chow. Sime is the president and CEO of Arcadia. She also serves in leadership roles at the Astera Institute and the Navigation Fund. She was priorly a professor of biophysics and biochemistry at UC Berkeley and co-founded a startup after her time there. We talk about the contingencies of biological research methods and Arcadia's response to them, the role of failure in the company philosophy, as well as different notions of diversity in science and beyond. Without further ado, I hope you enjoy our conversation. So, Sime, thanks so much for being here today.
You're welcome.
As a way of introduction to what Arcadia is, can you speak to the effects that running a scientist-owned for-profit venture has likely had on Arcadia's structure and practices? What's a scientist's vision of entrepreneurship, as you've put it once?
So there's lots of ways it's affected our structure and maybe just like how we even think about what's the priority. Because essentially, if you're a scientist, you believe very strongly that the science is number one, and that, you know, I basically believe that like the best products we could build, like starting from really, really solid science, is the most important thing. Like, it's garbage in, garbage out. And so it's affected a lot of things. It's affected how much emphasis we put on rigor, how much emphasis we put on sort of sharing and getting feedback on our work with the community openly, the way we publish to make sure it's not about showcasing, but rather about being as like true to what we do to get the right kind of feedback and rigor that we're hoping for. I think it's affected our budgeting in terms of like the composition of our team should be, you know, mostly scientists and, you know, thinking about the types of scientists that are good at like what aspects of the science as well, right? Thinking really carefully about, especially if you want to do like entrepreneurship, early work around that should be, you know, lots and lots of shots on goal, like a ruthlessness about shutting things down when they're not working, and like a very clear mind about what is the MVP to get you the answer you need to decide if you want to do more. And that's, it's a really different process than the type of science we do elsewhere, but it is still very like science focused. And with an understanding of like, what is the attrition rate of high quality, high risk science is really high. And so we sort of account for that in a way that I think like a lot of other places may not have the privilege to, or the perspective to really front load a lot of that work.
Yeah.
Happy to dive into any more of those. I mean, it's pretty like keeping it high level, but of course the devil's in the details.
That's true. Yeah. Could you maybe just give a very brief kind of overview of what Arcadia is in a nutshell? And then I'd be very curious to also ask about the history of kind of analogous structures, if any of them have existed before.
Yeah. So there's like lots of ways for me to answer that question. So I'll touch on some things at a high level and then dig in. I mean, at a high level, we are an experiment. We're an experiment of like a different way to set up an organization that could lead to the outcomes we want, which is to actually start companies that build products that are really useful to people. Right now, we're really focused on therapeutics, but we're playing around with everything in the company on like how we set this up to try and iterate towards something that works and is efficient. From a company level view, I mean, we're a biotech startup, you know, we're a for-profit company that's figuring out what our edge is in terms of how we leverage biology. And then our output is not the drug itself, but like companies that will, startups that will lead development of all sorts of different therapeutics. Our edge from a scientific perspective is that, and a business perspective, is that we think we can do a better job of figuring out the right starting points for biology. There's so much that we do in biology where the design process is extremely scientific, except for the first decision, which is, where do you want to look? You say, oh, I want to work on something and I've chosen E. coli. Well, why have you chosen E. coli? You chose E. coli for a whole lot of historical reasons that actually have very little to do with the goal that you have in mind, but just the inertia of just lobbying, communities, tool building, and all of that is like very precious. And I, you know, we stand on the shoulders of giants for that work, but we also live in a different time period now where we have way more data, way more tools, where we might be able to think a little bit more nimbly and from first principles of what you're actually trying to solve. And so a lot of what our research platform is around dealing with this problem. Like if you were an alien dropped in from outer space and you had all this publicly available data, and biology is nothing but a giant, giant library of data that evolution has given us, what would you actually choose to work on if your ultimate problem, let's say, was to solve like synbio, photosynthetic organism that scales in this way? There's like a bunch of different properties that you would be searching for that you might be able to actually sort of principally find. And so that's kind of like one half of the organization is thinking about how we do this. And the other half is a startup studio that takes all of these tools as our edge to figure out how they find their starting points to build companies that solve therapeutic problems.
Yeah. In that case, I suppose the question about the history of Acadia seems a little maybe misplaced, because I suppose it's only at this point that, you know, a lot of data combined, but maybe like a lot of funding also coming from various other sources like tech that can enable these sort of ventures. All of that kind of like makes this unique thing possible now. Or would you say there's actually been like analogous structures or like initiatives like Arcadia that have existed before that you've maybe even learned from in some way?
Yeah, I'm you know, I love to study the history of all sorts of science organizations. I mean, there's a lot of history there. I would say, I mean, what Arcadia is trying to do in this moment in time is pretty context specific. And so, you know, I don't think there's a bunch of examples that look exactly like Arcadia, but at a more conceptual level, there's been a bunch of efforts in the past where they've taken some set of conditions and some set of goals and really thought outside the box of how you could solve that. And like, you know, the classic example is, of course, Bell Labs, but there's others. There's Allen Institute, there's the Santa Fe Institute, there's, you know, Genelia, there's Biohub, there's all these different organizations that say, we have a slightly different set of goals and we'd like to maybe take a step back and think about how we optimize our setup for those sets of goals. And that's really the connection that we have across all of those. But I think the specifics are a little bit different for each, right?
Yeah. No, for sure. Speaking more about kind of the constraints that you kind of pointed to when you're, say, like a biologist in a research lab in a traditional academic institution, I read some of your writing in preparation for this interview where you're speaking about how you went into academia kind of expecting down the line to finally be liberated of like all the bureaucratic hurdles or finally attain like a state that seems very rare in the world where you're actually free to pursue very big, ambitious, open questions that the market might not immediately, you know, value or kind of monetarily compensate. You say, while I could see systemic issues as a student and postdoc, professorships felt like the only way to have a research program with the freedom to pursue knowledge for curiosity's sake. However, the full weight of academic pressures hit me like a ton of bricks the first year I became faculty. There was no liberation at the end of the path. So I'm interested in speaking more about the constraints of academia. Do you feel like this fact that there was no liberation at the end of the path, that actually the minority of time is devoted to scientific research, was intentionally obscure? Do you feel like it was a little bit of wishful thinking that people in grad school maybe engage with? Or is there like a, like what's the, I suppose, knowledge asymmetry between those that actually strive to attain that end goal and those maybe that aren't that end goal and don't really experience the freedom that you might have anticipated?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I would say that I don't think it was like intentionally obscured. I think some of it is actually just a process of growing up, you know, like you become an adult when you realize increased responsibility means increase in a whole bunch of other things, you know, not just increase in freedom. And I think it was also, you know, that's more like at a systems level, but I think also on an individual level, I think I also needed to grow up to better understand what is it that I'm even trying to bring to the table, you know, and like, what is my talent and contribution as a scientist? And I would say for me specifically, I'm a generalist, you know, I've jumped around between all sorts of different fields and that is my modus operandus and that's my preferred modus operandus. And like, that was something that was easier to do when I was a student and a postdoc, and harder to do when you're running a team. And that's, I would say that's like a truth that's not just academia, but anywhere, even in a company, even at Arcadia, I had way more freedom when it was like me and my co-founder, right? We could come up with whatever we wanted and pivot in a second. And then when you have 10 people, it's different. And then when you have 50 people, it's different. And academia is huge. And also, I think there was a switching of roles that happened, which is, you know, when you're a student and you're a postdoc, you're in training, and you realize when you become a PI that your job is to train. You know, like that is the fundamental role of academia, is to provide training and education to people, and not to just only do research. Research is certainly a part of it, but it's part of that mission, you know, and we're lucky when we can do other things as well. But I think that was the part that was the most, like the biggest realization, because you're not really in that role when you're getting trained, you know? And then when you flip it around, I was like, oh my God, I have actually an enormous responsibility for the people in my lab and the students that are around me. And that is my number one responsibility. And so I think that if we could get clear on this point earlier, that would actually maybe be the most helpful, to say in academia, our North Star is education. Mm-hmm. That is what gets confused, you know? Mm-hmm. And I think if I thought about that more clearly, I may have taken a different step earlier in the process.
Speaking more about kind of academia and maybe the private sector world, or however you want to call it, in preparing, I was glad to observe how much you seem to acknowledge like the role of the other, for lack of a better word, like what academia brings to the table versus what, you know, maybe startups or nonprofit organizations, anything alternative to it, bring to the table. It's not just like burn the one thing down, but rather you have a really healthy understanding. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I definitely don't take that view.
Yeah.
I actually, the view I take is like, the more we have other types of opportunities, such as like many people in the DeSci network, you know, just thinking about how we open that up and increase the surface area for many different types, that actually even helps academia, right? Because it redistributes everybody into the lanes that most suit their needs. And I really want academia to like be able to focus on their academic mission.
Yeah. So are there any like other underemphasized strengths and weaknesses of academia and maybe say startups, respectively? What do maybe like both worlds still get wrong about the other two?
Actually, let me take a more optimistic tone with this, which is that, you know, I think when I started Arcadia, you know, I was very much of just trying to like hungry to learn, you know, what could happen outside of academia. And what I realized in that process is like a PhD, there's real value to it. You know, like, I mean, not that I was going in with this hypothesis that it didn't have value. It's that, I really have learned the deep, deep value of it, which is different than what we might think, which is any opportunity to learn how to learn and develop some agency around that process is actually extremely important. What else is true is it doesn't have to happen through a PhD, but I think we undervalue this aspect of the PhD. And to me, that makes you like a learner, a generalist, and like competent in a world that's always changing. And that is like very hard to substitute if someone's never had some period of intensive growth in that way. And so I think that's one thing that maybe like, if I were to critique myself, is that I didn't have a deep enough understanding of that, which actually makes me more positive about academia in a way, you know? I think the thing that also, just, I'll just focus on myself, so I'm not like criticizing anybody else in this moment, but I think it's somewhat representative, is just how much science happens outside of academia. That's like a very big misunderstanding from the other side, is to imagine that basic science is sort of like belongs to something within a certain set of walls, when we're all on the same page here. We have different tactics for how we go about using that information or even generating it, but there is a huge world of science that happens outside of academia. Now I see it as like a slice of a pie, not the like majority of the pie, even for like basic science, research that happens. And so it's funny, like a lot of the stuff that like I now in retrospect, even for, you know, open science, when we think about disrupting publishing and funding and all that, oftentimes when I talk to people in academia, they don't even realize, like, I'm not talking about creating new publishing avenues for you. I'm talking about the rest of the pie that could use more support and like is very amenable to other ways of doing it, you know? And I think that's, I would love to help open people's eyes a little bit more to what happens and how much could be unlocked. And so those would be maybe like my top takeaways from my last few years that I think the other side doesn't understand. And then one more thing I would just layer above all that is, you know, my thinking has evolved around this valley of death thing that happens, like finding that like way to bridge basic and applied. When I first talked about it, I had a slide that was like a linear line and like, oh, here's the gap in the middle. And now it's not a linear line, actually. It's a third line of like a whole different style of science and training that should be happening if your ultimate outcome is to build a real world product. And it's probably looks a little different for Synbio than therapeutics and all of that. And so, I think I'm just like really just like it's been an education for me to challenge my own assumptions, which were mostly wrong.
So in kind of the first 2 years of Acadia, have there been any significant walls that you've run into, like kind of painful realizations that you've made in terms of what's possible, or in terms of like what's possible for especially like Acadia's initial aim? I'd be curious to hear how that's evolved and what you have maybe changed your mind about in the process of building it out.
Yeah. I wouldn't say like a painful wall, maybe just like a maturing of my understanding of what we are best poised to do. When I first started my, and I've talked about this elsewhere, but basically, so I'll try and keep it short. Basically, we thought, oh, we're gonna expand the universe of organisms that are studied by us being the institute where people kind of can bring their weird organisms to study. And then the first, maybe this is the wall, the first wall we hit was our indecision around which organisms. And it was like too much pressure. It was too much pressure to say, because 500 million is a lot of money, but it's not endless money. It was too much pressure to say, what are we going to decide and anoint as like the organisms that we care about?
Yeah.
And that indecision was the first very useful wall to take a step back and say, actually, answering that question by providing the tooling to scientists that could enable them to better assess this in a more data-driven way is going to be our mission. And if we can solve that just a little bit, it would increase the ability of not just Arcadia, but lots of scientists across different sectors to think more smart, be more smart, be more efficient about what they could work with, that would, the outcome would be an expansion of the types of organisms we work with. Because I just don't see how that could ever be possible if we are more data-driven about this, that we would still randomly pick the same set of organisms and only those organisms to work on forever. And I only say random, not because, you know, there are real reasons people chose them, but not always for the questions that we asked today, you know? So that's been like the biggest change in our entire research team and platform has restructured around that. It's not individual labs working on this and that. It's an entire like technology team whose whole goal is to figure out faster, better ways to sort of navigate the expanse of biology through genomes at the moment to find the signals, the patterns that would indicate like, here's something weird has happened or here's something really shared is happening that breaks our expectations around a model, you know?
To make that more concrete, maybe, do you have an example that just like excited you the most of maybe like, you know, a method or an organism that was chosen for historically contingent reasons, or maybe for valid reasons, but the questions have changed? What comes to mind when you're talking about it in the abstract?
Okay, well, here's an example that comes from outside of Arcadia, and then I can tell you an example from within. An example that comes from the outside is, you know, early on in the two examples maybe. Okay, early on when people sort of doubled down on E. coli, there were many good reasons for that. And E. coli has been an awesome workhorse for all sorts of biology, not even just for bacteria. However, if the decision had been made to double down on Pseudomonas instead at that moment, we would have found CRISPR probably like decades before. You know, it's a luck thing where you just happen to pick this organism that doesn't represent all of bacteria and has its own innovations from evolution. And then here's another one that looks maybe in some ways similar, but actually quite different. And so I think that's the kind of situation we're trying to avoid, right? That we want to make sure we're looking in all the right places for the things that we care about. And, you know, this is not even a criticism of any of those people involved, because it was just a different time where we didn't have the same technologies or resources to do much more, and a choice had to be made. But today is different. And so I want to make sure something like that doesn't happen again. Another example would be zebrafish. You know, zebrafish is also an excellent, excellent organism for research, but there's other fish, and there's fish that are more transparent and have other benefits. And I think there are people trying to actively expand that now, but it would have probably led to a different set of outcomes had we gone with like Danionella, a species that is fully transparent, you know? And so it's just interesting to think about these counterfactuals and like grapple with the weight of what that could have meant in terms of what science may have looked like today, and then to accept the reality that we don't have to make the same set of choices today. Like, we can upgrade the way we think about this, and we can be a little more nimble, and we should, and we should do it with like an urgency and aggressiveness, because the outcomes matter a ton. I also worry about, you know, for Symbio, you know, a lot of the challenges in Symbio right now around scaling, and you're limited to a fairly small set of organisms to think about engineering in for Symbio because of some of these historical reasons, which are even then further reinforced by regulatory things and otherwise. And so I would love to like think about how not at Arcadia, because we're focusing on therapeutics, but I've started to think about some of my nonprofit efforts, how we might take a step back and say, how do we help Symbio? Because I really do believe in the Symbio revolution, but we might need better starting points or more options to choose from that could enable from day one the ability to think about scaling. So, I think those are some examples. And then there's probably one more that I could dig into, which is thinking about our first startup that's going to spin out this year from Arcadia, which is a startup that's revolved around curing itch. And we chose itch for a number of reasons, including the fact that it's not been cured yet, and it's a very, very complex biological circuit. Many, many have tried and failed for all sorts of good reasons, but it's a great example of how we think maybe skip over the mechanistic building of the circuit, and is there a shortcut biology provides for how it's already been solved, or maybe we don't need to understand everything about it from day one. And that's where we found that ticks, as the most prolonged blood feeders, have like an enormous portfolio of molecules that are dedicated to making sure you don't feel them, that you don't itch, all of that. And we found some really interesting stuff that in turn has actually told us a lot more about the biology of itch in the end, like gotten us back into some basic science that's interesting, and is outperforming a lot of the other standards commercially right now in our you know, mouse behavioral model where we look at scratching. And so the interesting thing about that is, I didn't want to go too easy on myself on that, because the truth of the matter is, like, when we started Trove, it was because I had worked on ticks. So I had a hunch and I knew a lot about the biology. And that's exactly the situation we're trying to avoid, is how do we not let it be up to chance? That was a series of things that happened that made me realize that. And also, by the way, maybe I was wrong. Maybe I picked ticks because it's what I knew. But if we had taken a step back and done a principled search, we would have found something else. It's even better. And so we actually did do this exercise. We thought it was a valuable exercise to convince ourselves of whether our platform could be used. And because we actually did have experimental data from ticks, you know, that was in some ways a positive control. But the question is, could we find something even better? And so an example of how we looked for it is to say, okay, what are like gene families that are usually associated with things that might manipulate the CNS? And, you know, how could we find organisms based on that? And lo and behold, if you do that search and look for trends across evolution, you will find venomous creatures. And that makes a lot of sense, because their entire survival and strategy is around blocking or doing something to your CNS. And we did find that the more prolonged blood feeders had things that were indicative of more stuff around sensory. And so we kind of went full circle of a painful way all the way back to ticks. And what we found is like more things within the tick clades and maybe more gene families that we should be paying attention to. Because once you realize that, you say, okay, what other gene families have expanded in this set of organisms that are associated with itch now? And should we be actually looking at those? So it really has even helped us sharpen our hypotheses in a way that I think would speed up drug development for curing itch. So hopefully that helps give you a little more like concrete context.
For sure. Do you know whether there's maybe efforts that engage in a similar, almost like constructing the genealogy of different kind of knowledge standards? Or when you're, for example, talking about how synthetic biology is very, you know, dependent on like all this previous baggage of theorizing and maybe choosing particular model organisms and stuff. Are there people that systematically try to like reverse engineer a lot of like the kind of theory that led up to, I don't know, particularly just like things that biologists take for granted in the field today? Or do you think it's just particular research teams working on particular problems that kind of do this on an individual level? Or could you even see something?
I mean,
like
I think people who like evolutionary biology is all about this, right? So this is definitely like not a new idea at all. And I'm not even an expert on it, you know, but it is kind of the bent of like the field of evolutionary biology for the particular problem we're looking at to say, you know, like what has evolution taught us about how these organisms are really just single data points in a larger data set? Like what's the structural framework of that data set and how can we follow that down to find stuff? And there's many people that are much better at this than me. I think the unique thing here is to say, not only do I think that's awesome, but we're going to make like a for-profit company out of it. You know, that's literally a smarter investment. You're going to get more for your dollar if you have that information and that biological context. And it could lead to a lot of cool discoveries that are commercializable. And so to me, this is the thing that I'm most passionate about, is figuring out how we financially sustain a lot of this really, really important basic science. And we have every opportunity to, you know, many of the biggest like commercial discoveries have been from biology that happened through some process that we might, you know, lovingly say is luck. And I just want to like increase the chances of luck by using all the data we have. And like now today we sit in a different historical time too, with like computing and all the tools we have around that. We actually can do different things with the data that is biology writ large, you know?
Yeah. In terms of structuring Arcadia, you already mentioned a little bit earlier how it is structurally like quite different from maybe other startups, especially it's scientist run and all. But what beliefs have maybe proven to be particularly sticky in the people that you employ, who, like most of us, at least to some extent, were shaped by traditional institutions from K-12 all the way up to grad school? Is there anything that you kind of come across that's hard for people to adjust to, that have maybe like spent some time in academia or other differently structured ventures?
Let me, I'm trying to think about what have been the strongest signals. I mean, maybe one thing is just a willingness to be wrong and then a willingness to let go. And by be wrong, I don't even mean that, you know, I mean, I think we make guesses, right? That's what we do as scientists. We make guesses based on partial information and then we test them. There's an empiricism to the way we operate. And I think it's easier said than done. It's hard because you're asking a person to say, be passionate enough about a thing that you're willing to put it out there with conviction to test it, and then be rigorous enough to let it go the moment that you realize you're wrong. You know, it's a real fine line there. But I think that's where, if you are a real scientist who's after the truth, it's a little bit easier to do that because you have a clear sense of like you're after the right answer. You're not trying to be the right person, you know? And so I think that's definitely shown up in a lot of the things we do. I mean, the obvious ways are in our science. The less obvious ways are in our like operations, you know, where even with things like recruitment or how we set up other types of operations in the company, we try and bring a very scientific mindset to it to say, okay, you think it's working, show me the data, you know, show me why you think it's working. And how did you set up a priori your own internal test of what success might look like, and then show me how you studied it. And then if the moment we think it's not working, we scrap it. You know, I think that's really different from actually how a lot of operations are done. And it's challenging, but you know, the operations team we're trying to build here has to be aligned with that. And that's like a very scientific value that we hope like sort of is true across the entire organization.
Yeah. In my research for this conversation, I also came across a passage of yours on different notions of diversity, what you might call diversity in quotas versus diversity in mechanisms. Could you speak more to these different notions and their respective salience in contemporary diversity discourse, if you want to say
so? Yeah. So first of all, I'm a big advocate of diversity, but I want to make sure we approach it the right way, the smart way, so that we actually achieve that outcome for the right reasons and in a sustainable way. And as you know, like this can be an extremely polarizing topic. I can tell you that thinking of diversity as a quota is extremely problematic. It's been problematic for me even personally as like a woman in science to frame me as this, right? It like commodifies like who I am and my contribution and really undervalues that. And so to me, I think about it in the same way I think about diversity in biology, which is diversity is what gives you a diverse starting point, is what gives you the opportunity to have a lot of creative combinations and outcomes and gives you resilience for progress. And it's very dangerous to optimize for a narrow set of things because the world can change in an instant, as we saw in the pandemic in like a very, very poignant way, right? And that's true of us as like human beings. Our civilization needs to be resilient to all sorts of things that are changing under our feet right now. And then in terms of like pursuit of knowledge, we also need many different types of ways of thinking about things. So if you focus on that piece and not think of diversity as the outcome, but rather the mechanism that is important for the best outcome, like you think about it more clearly, you know, like it's not about like at the end of some recruitment process to say, okay, we're going to like try and reach some quotas, to say, how do we actually do the hardest thing in this question and think upstream and think about how we have set up the wrong starting conditions to enable that outcome that would be better, which is to have a broader pool of candidates, find talent where it lives. And so I've been thinking about this at Arcadia more in terms of, you know, how do we increase like training opportunities through internships or other things that help us kind of be surprised and find new talent early in the process that could like lead to really unique outcomes here that would be better for our goals even. And so I think I always get a little bit nervous and frustrated in this conversation because even I personally just, you know, it's like a terrible way to be talked about, to call someone, you know, a diversity candidate. Like, what does that even mean? Like a person is not a diversity candidate. That's not a thing, you know? Like not their fault that you have not been more broad in your search. I don't know if that answers your question. I'm happy to like dig in more to any of it.
No, I think it's really valuable, especially highlighting kind of the diversity of approaches and like the serendipity that should be like the outcome of this whole process, which we don't really talk about at all. Really, it's really focused on like, you know, the metric, which is maybe the easy out too. Like it requires less work in a sense too, and like less.
It does require less work. Yeah, it requires less work, and it's less likely to get you to the real outcome you're after. You know, and I should say, you know, like as someone who, so I, as you probably know, I also run some of our science stuff at Astera Institute, and then I chair the Navigation Fund, which are nonprofit projects. And there, I'm like deeply embedded in kind of the meta science space, and I'm worried about this for the meta science space, you know, that we have a real problem with the, you know, Matthews effect, where it's just like the winner's circle expanding. And there it's like reinforced by this thing where you have to like know a high net worth individual or have some access to that. And that's a problem because that means that we are only like enhancing this issue in a whole movement that is meant to increase opportunity to other people or more people so that we can actually increase, you know, sort of talent and outcomes. And I'm not really seeing that happening. I'm seeing the opposite happening. And so I'm worried about it. And, you know, this is why I'm excited to be on this podcast and to be interacting more with like the decentralized movement to really think about how we find more people and give more people a chance.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's a really tricky issue, kind of like finding, I think even in a lot of the programs that have maybe popped up in the last few years, even if it's, you know, trying to encourage young unknown, you know, people like undiscovered Einsteins or however they have marketed themselves, which are often like a lovely opportunity if you're already like in the right Twitter circles or like in the right country or like at the right Ivy League schools. Like I feel like sometimes there is a little bit of a you think you're discovering, you think you're making maybe counterfactual impact, but you actually it might have happened for that person like maybe a year later or something, and that can be significant. But are you, I guess what I've been really interested in is how hard it is to just find the people that would not actually find out about, like how to make sure that you're actually making counterfactual impact, I suppose, which, yeah, probably doesn't happen at Ivies as much as, you know, some state university. Like, how do you find the people that are outfindable right now?
Yeah, it's true. It's actually a very difficult question because if you make too much of a career ladder out of it, you actually just don't enrich for the people that you're looking for, which is those that would have fought for it either way, you know? So you're looking for evidence of that as like an intrinsic property of the person, and not trying to make it too safe for them. But then like, what's the angle? I think the angle could be, we want to, as you said, like this would be the table stakes angle is just, we're going to find those people and accelerate their efforts by a year or something. Right. That is the table stakes angle though. Like the real angle would be, we're going to find that person and like, think about like, how would they have fallen off though? Because not everybody can afford to do work for no money for a year, which happens a lot in the meta science world, right? Someone just is able to like float their own salary for a year until they get there or talk to the right person to find that money. And so that's what I'm trying to figure out actually at Astera, is like, how do we find people that are demonstrably doing it anyway, but if we don't like step in and fund them, they may fall off. And also when you're stepping in that early, it just means that your bets are, you're making a huge bet, right? Like it's actually very, very hard to know if like that person is going to be great. And so actually you should just like adjust all of your risk tolerance and attrition expectations based on that. Like if I'm going to go in this early, for every like 50 people I like support for a year, maybe like 5 people will work out, and that's great, you know? So I think this is like some of the stuff I've been thinking a lot about at Astera, and we're about to launch a residency program in March publicly that is meant to provide like a year of salary to someone who fits kind of what you and I are talking about right now. And it's going to be a big experiment too. Like, I don't know what the answer is. What I know is we tend to swing way too far on like, I want to see the awards and other things on someone's CV by that point. Mm-hmm. What are you doing? You're just actually helping people who are already being helped, you know?
Yeah. How are you thinking about, if you're already thinking about this concretely, like reaching out or sharing this program, maybe virtually, like even physically, like what's the strategy in reaching people?
So the strategy in reaching people is, I mean, stuff like this, doing an interview that might open up like a different audience. Another strategy is like, you know, trying to actually use my residents that are part of the residency program already to say, how are you going to also, like, if you care about this, how are you going to help me find people? And actually the small group of people that's sort of launching this together with me, we already did make a goal of saying, okay, before the end of the year, I would like to hire one more resident, at minimum one more, that none of us know and no one we know knows. I mean, I don't know if we'll hit that goal, but I think it's a worthwhile goal to actually make that the explicit thing of like, okay, that's hard. Like, how are we going to do this? So we can run, we're probably going to run some sort of like an event or series of events or symposium, and we'll find out. Like, that is the experiment, you know, and maybe we'll fail, but I hope that I have like a better answer for you in a year.
Sure. Yeah. I really like that ambition. Are you looking to for like physical events or anything like that, leaving San Francisco too, or is that particularly like kind of centered around the Bay?
Definitely, because so I've also started thinking about this, is that like, if we confine opportunities to people in areas where they can quickly set up a lab or resources or something, actually you immediately triage like a bunch of talent, right? That's kind of fucked up. So I've been trying to figure out, even like in the residency program, like who are creative people with creative ideas about how to solve this bottleneck even. So we're going to have both like science and science enabling tracks for this residency. And just to give you some examples of what I'm thinking for science enablement on this front would be, okay, like what's a faster, cheaper way for someone in a place that doesn't have like a biotech hub or a science hub to set up? Maybe it's to work with like a virtual cloud lab. Maybe it's to think about how they can have better access to CROs. Maybe it's like a whole bunch of other things that doesn't mean we build that up for them, but create the on-ramps that they don't need it, you know? So I'm very interested in this piece because I think like, while we can try and cast a wide net, there are real practical bottlenecks to people participating. And when I look at funding programs, when you say, okay, well, we're going to give you 200K, honestly, like that's only enough money for someone in an existing academic lab to do anything with it, because the ramp up is too much, you know? And so we're, shooting ourselves in the foot, like right away. Not because people in academia are not good, but because we want to cast a wider net. And that's actually like, this is really how you think about diversity. Right? You don't think about diversity as a quota. You think about this piece and all the different bottlenecks that are in place for people to participate. That's hopefully I'll have more to say on it, because a lot of this is just speculative at this point.
Yeah. But that all sounds really important and like the kind of hard work that has to go into it in order to actually solve like the diversity problem. This is not taking the cop out.
Yeah, in the first year of the residency program, I'm very open-minded because it can also be stuff like this, right? There's a lot of invisible labor when you're talking about creating a movement. It could be someone running a podcast and a Discord channel or something that creates a critical threshold of like community that more interesting and bigger things can happen. And that is also not often paid work. And so to me at Astaire, it's like, that's a great investment because I'm not just investing in that person. I'm investing in the creation of an ecosystem that later will produce even more people that I might be directly interested in investing in. Like it may not be you, and this is not a come on you, but it may not be you that starts the like billion-dollar company that saves the climate. Right. You know, it may be someone else, but you have to do this for us to get there, you know?
Right. Yeah. But it's like the kind of not even like quantifiable, like easily back traceable figures or projects that often have like these effects down the line. I guess lastly, I was very interested in your writing on kind of the increase of the odds of success if scientists have enough context to think concretely about whether science is useful. Which kind of breeds a different kind of creativity. Can you maybe speak to the sweet spot between that concreteness that is useful for creativity and also the maybe open-endedness that is traditionally maybe more associated, but probably unfairly so, with academia?
Yeah, I think, I can usually just talk best about, you know, things that we're actually working on. And so, there's been a whole journey for us at Arcadia of saying, how do we line up our science so that if it works, it can be maximally useful. And there's really no shortcut to this. There's no one who's going to tell you what to do, right? Like as a scientist, you actually just have to be very scientific about this yourself and think about like, okay, what is the end? Who is the end user? What is the end product and the moonshot that I'm after here? It's not a journal. It's not even another scientist. It's a patient. It's a patient who has a need. And who do I need to talk to better understand that need and think from first principles about how to work backwards from that? You know, it's talking to doctors, talking to patients, talking to other people who have built startups and failed and understanding like what happened. And it's a hard and messy process for which there's not a like really prescriptive set of tools, you know, because like the information has to live in the brain of the creative. And for you to like know that you can all go all the way back and say, yes, while I want to be open-ended in my starting point, because I have such limited information and I am going to make a bunch of guesses on this and follow that down. If you don't know what you're trying to follow that down towards, you're making decisions daily that you don't even think about usually as a scientist, like what's the phenotype you're measuring? How clean does that need to be? Like what regulations should I be thinking about? You know, like I'm trying to basically equip each person to be in the organization more polymath about all of this, because it's not a thing where at some point some VC is going to like tell them what to do next, you know? And their ideas may end up being even better than anything someone could tell them, because they have the science in their brain to actually be more creative about this. So to me, the constraints are not really confining, but more useful container to actually flex your creative muscles in, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. When did you start thinking about, I suppose, the patient as kind of the end goal, and also just the, like, when did the realization maybe enter your mind that there are so many implicit judgments that you're making if you don't, for example, focus on the patient, if you can, you know, trace that back to any period?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I can definitely trace it back. It was when I was spinning out my first startup, Trove, right, with my co-founder, Kira. The story is basically in my lab was working on sort of tick microbe interactions. We were really interested in vector-borne diseases. And because of that bent, we were really interested in looking at antibacterials and things that sort of regulate the interactions between ticks and their microbes. And so ultimately, what did I want? I wanted my research to lead to something that could help, you know, at that point, like patients who were suffering from tick-borne diseases, such as Lyme, as an example. And so it wasn't like I didn't care about that. I did care about that. I wanted to improve health outcomes. Did it have to be for Lyme? No, not necessarily, but that was what I was working on. So then I thought, okay, we found all these cool antibacterials. Let me figure out like if any of them are commercializable. And so it wasn't until like pretty late in the game that I started talking to doctors, investors, you know, also startup founders about, oh yeah, should I follow this down with this antibacterial? And pretty soon I just got slammed with this like understanding that that's a pretty tough market. Not clear if ticks provide a very unique opportunity on this. Like, it's sort of like I have this hammer and I'm looking for nails, you know? And then, yeah, it did force me to say, okay, well, actually, I just want to help people. So like, what's, if I have this system, like, what is the way to help them? And actually think more clearly with investors and others about, you know, like, where is there a gap? And where are people suffering? And people suffer a lot from itch. That was what I learned. And that was, you know, my worldview was very narrow until I started doing this, of realizing there's all sorts of other health things. I mean, that sounds really naive, but like, yeah, there's way more to think about here, and that way more I could act on with my system too. It doesn't have to be this thing that I thought. And so that was really like my process. I talked to people in tech transfer offices, other scientists. It was just like hundreds of conversations to kind of finally whittle it down into, okay, I think I've convinced myself that there is a there, but the unique angle is going to be itch. And I actually feel like conviction that we could try it. But then now, what is the next set of things I need to do to really convince myself that that's true? And that's how Trove started. It is like a clarity around the key milestones that are next that need to happen. And so, yeah, I don't, I think in the future, we'll probably have more tools to figure out how to systematize this type of thing. And I'm excited for that future. But as of today, I think what I try and like talk about with our scientists at Arcadia is like, it's you, you know, you have to figure this out. Like, if you want to be a founder and an entrepreneur, you have to think about this, and you have to get out there and not be afraid to just call up whoever.
Yeah.
and figure it out, you know?
Right. Yeah. I'm certainly really excited to see what comes out of this in the next few years. And thanks so much for taking the time to talk again today.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. Thank you.